The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and careers. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch. We welcome you to the show. Thank you for stopping by as usual. We're going to be talking about Syria today. A lot of people have been seeing that's going on in the news. And if you know, you've been paying attention, there's a lot of things going on. We've got this refugee situation. We've got the Russians are talking about putting more military support into Syria to support the regime. We've got the ISIS situation. There are a number of different things that are going on with Syria that have implications not only for international security, but for U.S. national security. And we're going to talk about that in the first segment of Fed Access today. We've got one of our common guest from Stratfor. They're on with us right now. We've got the Director of Analytical Support, Sim Tak, is with us right now. Stratfor is a geopolitical intelligence and advisory firm. They're down in Austin, Texas, but they monitor everything that's going on around the world, and they've got a handle on what's going on in Syria, and we're going to get some expertise, some insight on that today. Sim, how you doing? Welcome to Fed Access.
Thank you very much. It's awesome to be on.
You know, talk to us. What's going on in Syria? You're looking at this on a regular basis, Sim, and what's happening right now in this whole Syria situation? What are we seeing with the Russians? What are we seeing with this the refugee situation? What are we seeing with ISIS?
So basically, the big, you know, kind of setting the stage for all of this taking place, the situation Syria is in right now is one where the rebel groups and the Islamic State continue to advance against the regime. The regime is barely holding on to the territories that it holds along the coast and in Damascus. And then, of course, so we're seeing the Russians sending in forces to support the Syrian regime, not necessarily a intervention in the sense of, big combat units that are going to sway the battlefield, but they are sending advisors, equipment, potentially even aircraft to deliver air support to Syrian regime forces. So we're basically seeing the Russians, supported by Iran as well, coming in to shape that battlefield in a way that allows the Syrian regime to hold on to its core areas.
You know, there was a whole dynamic in terms of the U.S. was going to be supporting those who were kind of opposite of the opposition forces of the regime. And there were also going to be maybe some of the other Western countries were going to be putting that either military support or some kind of aid support. Is that still going on? It seems like you got about three different parties going on in Syria. And tell me if that's right. ISIS, the opposition forces, and then Assad's forces.
Right. And so that's where it gets kind of complicated. You do have these different things going on at the same time. The U.S. effort is mostly geared towards the Islamic State right now. Obviously, the U.S. has a stake in the larger fight of the rebels against the Assad regime, but their real efforts in terms of planned aerial operations are mostly against the Islamic State. And in that regard, we still have the ongoing attempt by Turkey and the U.S. to cooperate in establishing that buffer zone along the Turkish border, where they would deliver air support to rebels on the ground.
You know, as we look at this situation and we start looking at the refugees, what's going on? Is it just a dynamic that the entire country, Damascus and everywhere else, is so war-torn that now the civilian population is just trying to escape from ISIS, escape from the regime, and even from the dynamic of the opposition forces? Are people kind of feeling like we don't have anywhere to go, and so we have to start moving into Europe and other places?
Well, keep in mind that the refugee crisis, as far as it concerns Syria, is not a new dynamic. The phenomenon of internally displaced persons has been going on since the beginning of the Syrian war. Syrian refugees have been flooding into Turkey, into Europe, for as long as this war has been going on. The thing that's really bringing this to the front right now is the effects that that Europe is feeling, and most notably due to the intense media attention that has been given to the accidents involving boat refugees on the Mediterranean.
So this is not necessarily a new situation. It's just now getting more media attention. Have there always been the numbers of people, you know, trying to get over into Europe, or has there been an increase for some reason?
There has definitely been an increase, but then it's also important to note that the European refugee crisis does not consist entirely or even for a majority out of Syrian refugees. We have a lot of refugees coming from the Balkan countries. Mm-hmm. We have a really large portion of East African refugees making it to Europe through Libya, which is, you know, another place where the security situation there has allowed for that refugee flow to shape this way.
You know, as we look at this entire region, and you know, of course, there's right now in the news that the U.S. is talking to Russia and saying they're putting warnings out to Russia right now. Where do you see that conflict playing out? I mean, if Russia, you know, puts boots on the ground, or if they already have boots on the ground, is there a concern that there's going to be a major conflict between the powers of the United States and the Russia? Where do we see this kind of thing playing out?
So I think right now, with the different intents that the United States and Russia have in the conflict, I don't think we're moving towards a Russia versus United States war in Syria here. One of the narratives that we at Stratfor have actually been following really closely is the track towards negotiations over a more permanent resolution to the Syrian conflict. When it comes to the fighting on the ground, it's a very messy situation. The end isn't exactly in sight yet, but we have seen a lot of the important actors, being the Arab countries in the region, being the United States, being Turkey, being Russia. We have seen all of them shape up and start talking to the people that they have influence with inside Syria. So being from the Turkish, Arab, and U.S. part, their favorite rebels, so to say. And on the Russian part, you know, they are talking to the Assad regime. And all of these separate communications are kind of coming together to a point where these outside actors are trying to shape the negotiation between some reliable rebel factions, the regime, so that they can actually come to some type of agreement where the civil war in Syria can be ended.
Do we see that happening anytime soon, Sam? Is this, you know, a dynamic where there's going to be a split Syria? Are we talking about, you know, another situation like Sudan or other countries that end up split up into two countries, you know, with each one having control over certain areas? I mean, where are we going forward? Or is there an effort to bring these parties back together without Assad?
So that is the important question there, right? While I say that, you know, all of these actors are shaping up their attempts to force these negotiations, at the same time, there are tremendous constraints to the actual success of them on all sides. Mm-hmm. You've got the United States, who is unsure of which rebels they can work with, both for reasons of, you know, avoiding having jihadi actors among the rebels that they work with or that they support. They have the issue of none of these rebel groups actually being a strong enough force to be able to actually rule parts of Syria. You know, when you have a negotiated settlement, you actually need actors to be able to take responsibility over real-world territory to manage it. And then on the opposite side, where the Russians and the Iranians are negotiating with the Syrian regime, you know, there is the big question of the future position of Assad. Is Assad the party that people will negotiate with, or will there be other Alawite Syrian leaders that take that position? So far, you know, the U.S. and the Arab Gulf countries have not accepted the idea of Assad still being an element in this negotiation, while Iran and Russia and, of course, the Assad regime itself are very adamant about the fact that Assad is still the key figure that represents the Alawites of Syria.
We're talking about what's going on in Syria. We're talking to Simtek. He's director of analytical support services at the geopolitical intelligence firm Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com. They are monitoring the situation that's going on not only in Syria but Iraq, but also Libya and other areas. And we're going to kind of get a understanding of why this area is important, why Syria is important, and also get an understanding of what else is going on around this region in terms of Libya, in terms of parts of Africa and the Middle East, and also this refugee crisis that's happening right now. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we have been talking about the Syria crisis. We've been talking about the refugee crisis. We're talking about what's going on with ISIS. We're talking about everything that's happening in the Middle East and the Africa region. There's a lot of things going on that has an impact on U.S. national security, but also international security that we're seeing that's playing out in the news. And we're wondering, where is this going to go? What is the forecast for the future? We're talking to some experts on this, the people from Stratfor. We're talking to Simtek. He's director of analytical support at Stratfor. They're a geopolitical intelligence and advisory firm in Austin, Texas, but they do it all. They monitor a number of different situations around the world, but they definitely have their eyes on what's happening in Syria, Iraq, and the Middle East and Africa. Sim, you know, when you look at this situation right now, and you know, we kind of talk about, you know, Syria, you talk about Assad and all the other kind of dynamics and the conflict and the opposition forces. You know, a lot of people say the battle for ISIS is kind of the priority, and that's where the U.S. has been putting a lot of emphasis in right now. You know, some people, the Russians or other people, will say the current regime is the best one to battle ISIS right now. You know, with all of this, how are people kind of quiet? It seems to be kind of a mess over there in terms of the battle for ISIS. What's going on?
So right now, actually, what we're seeing is that most of the actors that have a stake in combating ISIS are actually on the same side and are cooperating. One of the major shifts in this recently has been the position of Turkey, where Turkey, you know, early on when ISIS invaded Iraqi territory, they kidnapped a group of Turkish diplomats, which were then later released, and there seemed to be kind of a non-spoken agreement that Turkey would not bother ISIS while, you know, ISIS would not bother Turkey. Now, in the last few months, however, we've seen a radical shift in the Turkish position, where they have started to clamp down on ISIS activity inside Turkey, across the border into Syria, and now they're talking about setting up a buffer zone along their border together with the U.S. And then this entire operation, the cooperation between those actors, puts an immense amount of pressure on the Islamic State itself.
You know, when we look at this situation and you know, you're looking at ISIS as overall, are we seeing a weakened ISIS? Are we seeing a still kind of, you know, strong ISIS? Are we seeing a solidified group, or are we seeing a break apart of the organization because of the bombings that the U.S. is doing, because of this unified effort? What are we seeing with them right now?
So compared to the beginning of operations against them, we are definitely seeing them in a very much weakened position.
Okay.
They have lost control over the oil assets that they were using to financially and logistically support themselves. They have lost large amounts of territory inside Iraq. And, you know, with Turkey joining the fight, they are seeing very, very limited options to keep both foreign fighters and equipment and money going into the ISIS-held territories in Syria and Iraq. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean that IS is on the verge of collapsing. They still have control over large areas. They still have local populations, local tribal elements supporting them. And this is where the operation to remove ISIS from those areas becomes very nasty in terms of going into the population centers and you know, rooting out the ISIS supporters one by one.
You know, with this economic kind of maybe downturn for them, but although them still holding certain key areas, is this more of a long-term battle to kind of continue to wither down certain resources? And as those resources continue to get withered down, then, you know, hopefully the local control, because they don't have the money, they don't have the finances to pay fighters and to sustain a government. Is that kind of the game plan that we're seeing from the coalition forces?
Yes, it is. But then it's also very important to note that this is not because of choice, but because of the limitations on the operations against IS. Much of this has been achieved through the air campaigns of the U.S., European countries, Arab countries supporting it. But the one thing that this coalition really lacks is boots on the ground. I mean, nobody is seeking to go back into Iraq the way they went in there in 2003. So they are very much depending on the Iraqi military. The Iraqi military is in a really poor shape right now. There's a lot of training, re-equipment programs going on. But then at the same time, they've also had to depend on popular forces, on tribal elements, and even on Shiite militia supported by Iran. That's one of the parts where this whole operation is really constrained and still taking shape. On the Syrian side of the border, we have the same issue then where the U.S. and Turkey have to work with local rebels. Some of those rebels have ties to jihadi elements, which makes them unfeasible to work with, while other of those rebel groups simply have very limited capabilities.
You know, I've always wondered, and you know, you're looking at this with, you know, very, very critical eyes. When we talk about the resources that have been put into the Iraqi army and then we still say that they're not prepared, what is going on with the army? Is it more of a situation that the training is not there? Is it more of a situation that the commitment is not there? What happens that, you know, that there is this, or is it just kind of factions in the Iraqi army that are not getting along? What happens that they're not prepared to take on this fight?
So, first of all, what is causing those limitations on the Iraqi army? That's pretty much all of the above. They have had training, they have gotten equipment, but keep in mind that this is a very, very new army. This army has only been established after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which means that in higher level terms, this army has a non-existent history or tradition or doctrinal history. They are basically trying to build themselves out of nothing, while at the same time, there are the internal political differences in Iraq that also shape the way that the army operates. The largest population group within the military are the Iraqi Shiites, which are mostly dominant in Baghdad and the region south of it, while the regions that we see IS fighting for are the Sunni regions to the north and west of them. So basically, you can imagine that as a Shiite soldier, Shiite units have less of a motivation to fight and lay down their life for the Sunni areas of Iraq where Sunni jihadists are revolting.
You know, it seems as if in Iraq and Syria, and Sim, tell me if this is correct, it seems as if things are so disjointed and there are so many different sides that are pulling. Iran and Russia and other people are all kind of pulling on these different sides. It doesn't seem that these countries are going to come together anytime soon. Would it be better that if they just all kind of separate and you have a Shiite state, a Sunni state? Would that be a better game plan for that region?
The big problem in that plan is that when you look at the Shiite state, if it were to exist, this would be a very successful state in terms of resources. They hold the access to the Persian Gulf and all the oil resources in Iraq. You would have the Kurdish area, which also has some oil resources, which would potentially be a feasible state. But then when you look at the Sunni state, there's nothing there but sand. A state cannot sustain itself on, the export of sand. So the idea of splitting up Iraq means basically condemning the Sunni society to having nothing. And that is actually the whole marginalization of the Sunni population is actually what has given birth to groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda in Iraq before it. This is exactly the problem that leads to the radicalization, to the resistance and rebellion in this area. So the only real way for a long permanent solution to be put in place would be to have a plan that includes a reintegration of the Sunni population into the actual political leadership of that area.
Do you see, when you look at Syria and you look at Iraq, do you see that there are parties who are actually sitting down and talking about this reunification, or are things still very much split and people are not talking to each other?
There are definitely talks about this, and this is actually one of the things that the U.S. has been pushing for as well, and especially when we're talking about their efforts to retrain the U.S. military and re-equip them. We have seen the U.S. put a lot of emphasis on limiting the role of the Shia Iraqi military officers and kind of pulling the Kurdish and Sunni Iraqis to the front, so they can carry a bigger role, which means they have more responsibility. They are able to rely more on the state because of the bigger role that they have in it.
You know, Sim, we could go on and on. This is a long topic. I just want to thank you for your insight. We have to have you back because this is a long, complicated topic that we're trying to get an understanding of. And I think the American public needs to get an understanding of as we go forward. Thank you for your insight on what you've provided today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Sim Tech. He's Director of Analytical Support at the Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence and advisory firm that is focusing on all the different issues, and they definitely have a handle on Iraq, and we would definitely keep on talking about this story. When we come back, we're going to be talking about cyber issues, so stay tuned. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about what's going on in Syria and Iraq, but we're going to switch gears right now. We're going to switch gears into the cyber issues. An interesting article came out about cyber espionage and how it may change the dynamics of governance out there. We're going to continue to talk to some experts at Stratfor, but we're going to talk to Tristan Reed. He's a security analyst at Stratfor. Again, Stratfor is a geopolitical intelligence and advisory firm out there in Austin, Texas. But Tristan is joining us from San Diego out there, enjoying the heat out there in San Diego. I've spent some time out in San Diego for many, many different reasons. But Tristan, hey, welcome.
Thanks, Derek.
Hey, talk to us about this whole kind of the cyber espionage and how it may change the dynamics of governance. And also, even with cyber espionage, there's been a number of different things talked about people pulling back off the web or the change of certain things and a number of intelligence services having a hard time. What's going on with this?
Well, you know, I mean, it's been well publicized, the effects of hacking, cyber attacks around the world, and, you know, in countries spying on one another in cyberspace. You know, China is perhaps, you know, one of the most well publicized aggressors in cyberspace. But of course, you know, United States and any country with technical capabilities has been engaged in cyber espionage. You know, there's a particular issue, though, when it comes to economic espionage, because, you know, espionage activities in general, they're normally, you know, have always been par for the course. You know, they're accepted in international relations. Economic espionage, you know, it directly threatens the economic interests of a country. And with, you know, the increasing reliance on the internet, virtually any business can be touched by this. And countries are increasingly engaging in cyber espionage, and it's very difficult for these governments to defend the private sector against such attack.
You know, with this happening, are we starting to see that companies are now, I mean, you know, because there was a whole big push about moving things to the cloud, you know, and everything was to the cloud and making sure all your services are running in this one area. But as we're seeing kind of maybe more aggressive and maybe even more successful hacking attacks, and I don't necessarily know the full stats on the penetration rates, but as we're seeing this happen more and more, are we starting to see the private sector and maybe government and everything else start to say we need to pull back off the web, we need to pull services off the cloud, we need to start kind of looking at how we maybe keep intellectual property maybe on computers that are not connected to the web? Where is this going?
You know, pulling off the web is not an option for most governments and virtually any internet-based company. You know, the connectivity around the globe is the bread and butter of what makes internet so valuable for the private sector. But what we are seeing is the various governments around the world attempting to digest cybersecurity into their foreign and domestic policy. You know, even though hacking has been an issue, you know, most people have been aware of for more than a decade now, it's still a relatively new concept in defense for governments. And over the course of the last decade, we've been looking at how governments are attempting to grasp the idea of cyberspace and what the role of the military and their intelligence services play in it. And at a higher level, there's even been a debate over global internet governance, sort of a polarized debate between the United States and countries like China and Russia.
When we talk about internet governance, is that the dynamic of maybe changing, you know, how now the, I'm assuming the internet kind of is governed by this one body. Are we now talking about maybe countries developing their own governance systems in which it won't be the body that has, you know, control over different domain names and other things like that? Is China going to develop their own thing? Russia going to develop their own thing? And the U.S. will have their own? How is it looking?
So the current model for internet governance that's largely accepted around the world is sort of a decentralized model. It's been deemed the multi-stakeholder model, where the public and private sector are equal partners in deciding the policies and technology standards that make up the internet. China and Russia and a few other countries, they want internet governance to be controlled by the governments and governments working together to sort of regulate the policies and technological standards. Now, that's the wider polarized debate. But what's happening right now is countries are simply setting their own national policies on internet activity and cybersecurity, and it varies greatly. You have countries such as Russia, which is, you know, beginning to demand companies that collect online information from Russian users to store their data centers inside Russian territory. You have the European Union that's attempting to implement some sort of standardized cybersecurity strategy among the EU member states. So the national policies are varying, and what's creating is more of a fragmented regulatory environment with internet activity.
When you talk about this kind of fragmented regulatory environment, what does that mean for American or anyone in business? What does that mean? Is it going to be more difficult to now do business in these other countries in terms of the regulations that they're going to have to say, listen, if you want to have your domain name or your internet service kind of coming into China or other places, you have to abide by our regulations that are now maybe different than what you abide by U.S. regulations? What does that mean? What are the implications of that?
So if this trend continues, if we continue seeing these countries, you know, making, you know, desperate efforts to protect their infrastructure and their economic interests in cyberspace, what it means for businesses is that you're simply going to have different compliance issues depending on where your market is around the world if it's based on internet activity.
You know, when we look at the cyber espionage piece, how worried and how how much of a threat is this for companies? You know, as we think about companies going into other countries or China or Russia or wherever the case is, and we think about the intellectual property of not only our defense industry, but also if it was a company like Coca-Cola or Apple or whoever the case is, where is this becoming in terms of a priority for companies right now?
You know, economic espionage has for a very long time been a significant concern for virtually any company that's got sensitive intellectual property or just trade secrets in general. Cyber espionage has taken it to another level where the number of potential attackers, the agents of economic espionage, has expanded because of the less risk and less resources required to engage in cyber espionage. Virtually all business records are stored digitally now, which means they're accessible in some way from a computer network. So it's a concern that every company shares. It's a growing concern, and it's forced a lot of companies to put quite a bit of emphasis on cybersecurity as part of their overall information security.
You know, as we think about this, and I want to go into this in the next segment, Tristan, you know, as we think about the next layers of protection, you know, is what we currently have in terms of a model of protecting of cybersecurity, is it the right model, or are we seeing that it's an outdated model of security? Are the systems, do we need to improve, or are the hackings becoming even much more powerful and much more successful than now even with the cybersecurity experts? I want you to kind of just think about that. I want to talk about that in the next segment. Right now, we're talking to Tristan Reed. He's a security analyst at Stratfor, a geopolitical intelligence and advisory firm out there in Austin, Texas. But they monitor everything from what's going on around the world to cyber issues and any kind of threat and political risk situations that are out there. We're talking about what's going on with cybersecurity, what's going on with cyber espionage, and how do we deal with it? How do we handle it as we go into the future when we can't get off the internet, but we have to protect our secrets while we're on the internet? We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about cyber espionage. We've been talking about what's going on with cybersecurity. We've been talking about how hackers have begun to, but they have been for a long time trying to use the internet to penetrate some of our American companies and just companies around the world, and also government agencies. But how do we deal with this situation? And also, it is seeming that it may change some of the regulatory dynamics amongst countries, and that may have some impact on how we do business around the world. We're talking to Tristan Reed. He's a security analyst at Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence and advisory firm. They're out there in Austin, Texas, but they monitor everything from cyber to the Middle East to world situations to terrorism, and we're talking about cyber espionage today. Tristan, you know, when we look at it, and let me even take a step back just for maybe a layperson who doesn't understand maybe espionage or cyber espionage. If you had to define cyber espionage, how would you define that?
Cyber espionage, it's basically just monitoring any sort of activity, whether you're targeting business or a government. It's essentially breaking into someone's network, compromising their devices that contain sensitive information, and exfiltrating that information.
You know, when we look at it, we just saw kind of the, and you know, not to trivialize anything, but we saw the Ashley Madison situation. We saw, we've seen the Sony hacks. We've seen a number of different situations where companies have been hacked and information has been used to blackmail people or to do whatever with that. And I was asking the question, do we have the secure networks, or do we need to change the way we are doing cybersecurity?
And that's the question that governments are actually asking right now, mm-hmm. because it's not necessarily an arms race where you have defensive measures followed by more advanced offensive measures. Offensive measures in cyberspace is quickly outpacing any defensive measures. Right. At least that's what the appearance is, because the number of opportunities for cyber criminals, for government agents, for rivals to target one another grows. And as time goes on, the internet population grows, which means you're having a potentially larger pool of individuals that will engage in this type of activity. So it's for that reason that we're seeing more and more examples, high-profile examples of cyber attacks, and where, you know, either a company is being targeted for some sort of hacktivism, or a company is being targeted for economic gains in the case of economic espionage.
You know, with this, and you know, we kind of talk about the state actors, and you know, and where we, you know, we all commit espionage. You know, they commit espionage against us, and we're going to try to do the same thing against them in terms of foreign adversaries, in order to make sure that we protect ourselves as well. But when we look at it, there's also a growing element, and you know, of that criminal enterprise that goes well beyond cyber espionage. Would we say that is the espionage more the threat, or the criminal enterprise, or they're both the same at this point in time?
They're largely both the same as far as threat level goes, okay. Because it doesn't have to be economic espionage to cause substantial losses for a company. You know, the cyber attacks, you know, you cited the well-reported Ashley Madison case, for example. A cyber attack doesn't have to be related to espionage. It can simply be a matter of sabotage. And it's still extremely costly. Now, the actual skill sets employed You know, whether you're looking to steal credit card numbers from a company or you're looking to steal trade secrets to profit off of in your home country. And the skill sets are pretty much the same. You know, you're already talking about an environment where it's very difficult to attribute an attack to someone if you're even aware of the attack in the first place. But it becomes more complicated when there's multiple motives that could be at play. You know, whether an individual or an organization is committing cyber attacks to sabotage a business or to spy on it.
You know, with all of that, and as we look at the dynamics of security, and you guys are seeing the threats, is there anything that you're advising? You know, and I'm sure you're talking to different companies and looking at the threat and analyze it. Is there anything that you're advising, whether it be a small, mid-size, or large corporation or government agency, in order to kind of say, hey, listen, this is how you protect yourself? And from what I'm understanding, that there's also the concern right now that the threat that sometimes people can, you know, build a security in their own systems, but the threat goes beyond that because it's about the personnel and how much they keep themselves secure even after they leave the facility or after they do certain things, because sometimes they can make themselves vulnerable and cause damage to the organization.
That's very correct. I mean, insider attacks are perhaps the most difficult to defend against. You know, any major corporation at this point has realized the importance of cybersecurity and even creating departments specialized specifically in cybersecurity, separate from, you know, information security and IT. So most corporations have understood it, but small, medium businesses are also being targeted. Perhaps, you know, not necessarily for economic espionage, but simply just sabotage or financially based crimes, you know, stealing your customer's credit card information. So it's a concern that everyone, no matter how big or how small a business is, should be concerned with cybersecurity and should devote the time to training its personnel and staff in terms of best practices in cybersecurity.
Are there any best practices that are out there right now, Tristan, that people can, if they were listening, they could say, you know what, oh, I didn't think about that, or sometimes it's simple stuff, but are there anything that's out there right now that people can just jump on?
I mean, certainly for a business, they should invest into a cybersecurity team, one that specializes in looking at, you know, the protocols of its information technology infrastructure, one that can train staff, you know, it's particularly when it comes to malicious emails, spear phishing attacks, where a cyber criminal will design an email specifically to convince you or a targeted individual to click on a malicious link or engage in some sort of activity that compromises their system. That's something that staff should be regularly trained on.
You know, with that, for a small business, are there now maybe services out there where people can kind of, you know, say, hey, listen, I got to, you know, put me together a cybersecurity team? Because you mentioned small, medium sized businesses, and sometimes those companies have some of the best intellectual property because they may be working on the next either invention or they may have some very, very secure information as a small business because they're very, very proprietary or who they work with or whatever. But are there now other, you know, kind of services now that say, listen, you can bring on an outside cybersecurity team that will monitor your network or look at your cloud or other things like that? Is that happening more and more?
Absolutely. I mean, cybersecurity as a field is quickly growing, which really just highlights, you know, the importance and concern that that businesses are having now in terms of, you know, being attacked in cyberspace. So there's an increasing number of firms globally that specialize in cybersecurity, specializes in consulting with any size business in terms of how to improve and secure their infrastructure and protect their trade secrets and their sensitive information.
You know, we've only got a couple of seconds left, Tristan. When we look at the situation in terms of cyber espionage, do you think that the U.S. and our government agencies, do we have a handle on this situation right now? I know the president talked about developing kind of maybe a cyber intelligence a team and everything else. As you look at the scope and as you're analyzing this, are we on the right track in terms of what we're doing, or are we behind this, you know, this thing? And still need to put more resources into it.
You know, the United States exemplifies the idea that technical capabilities, offensive capabilities in cyberspace does not necessarily equate to defensive measures. The United States is shown to be one of the most advanced and most sophisticated in cyber espionage globally, but yet the government and its private sector continually falls victim to other countries, whether it's Russia or China, or even countries that largely don't have connectivity to the internet, like North Korea.
Right.
So, you know, the U.S. is in a particular position because it's trying to back this multi-stakeholder model where the private sector has equal say in how the internet is governed. The U.S., you know, it's any perceived government reach into the private sector's internet infrastructure and activity is politically sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so the U.S. has had to sort of rely on foreign policy, trying to find deterrence that will stop countries like China from attacking government interests and business interests. There are largely two different issues, though, when you're talking about general espionage activity, spying on the government as opposed to spying on companies. And the reason why is because government interest tends to be on public sector infrastructure. Even though the U.S. government still relies heavily on the private sector's internet infrastructure, it's within their ability to consolidate and to find technological solutions that better guard their own networks. But when it comes to protecting the economic interests, protecting the private sector, the U.S. government doesn't really have much control or many options, so they're forced to pursue foreign policy, which thus far hasn't been effective.
Tristan, I wish we could talk about this more. I wish we had more time. I'll have to have you back because we were just getting into the nitty-gritty about kind of policy and really the differences between the governments in terms of our private sector and you know, trying to kind of prevent government overreach. And then sometimes, you know, countries that don't necessarily have that same kind of a system where the government in China or maybe Russia, they can go in and overreach because a lot of the things are state-owned or they have that kind of control over certain sectors. Thank you for your insights, and we definitely got to keep on talking about this more. We appreciate having you on Fed Access.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Fed Access. We'll be back next week with the new show. Thank you for stopping by. We'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.